It's Friday, March 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Japan marks the fifth anniversary of the massive earthquake and tsunami that triggered one of the world's worst nuclear accidents. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy moves a step closer to taking over the reins of government in Myanmar. And country music star Chris Stapleton campaigns for mental health awareness. It's all ahead. Japan Friday observed the fifth anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami that killed 18,000 people. Japanese leaders gathered for a moment of silence at the exact time the tsunami struck Japan's northeast coast. Some of the devastation still remains. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has pledged to increase reconstruction efforts in northern Japan, where the earthquake and tsunami set off a meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. The Japanese Red Cross Society says thousands of families and elderly people are still displaced. I spoke with VOA correspondent Steve Herman, who describes his memories of the disaster.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like 5 years, Sarah. We were on the ground in Fukushima about 24 hours after the tsunami. And my takeaway from 5 years later is we really had no idea of the scope of this disaster and how perilous it was, not only from the meltdown of the reactors that were going on in Fukushima Prefecture when we were there, but the fact, which we found out later, that the nation really came close to something unimaginable, which would have been evacuating large cities such as Tokyo. In a way, despite the huge toll, 20,000 people killed mostly by the tsunami, 250,000 buildings destroyed, and nearly 400,000 people made homeless. In retrospect, you know, Japan got out of this quite fortunately because you can imagine what it would have been like if millions, if not tens of millions of people had to have been evacuated.
I know you're a regular visitor to Japan. In your visit since, how do you think the country has changed since then, or has it?
Oh, I have no doubt that the country has changed. Just the debate that has gone on over the years about nuclear power, that was something that not a lot of people really thought about prior to this disaster. How to better prepare communities for something as unthinkable as tsunami that are tens of meters of high coming not only in the nuclear power plants but into communities and washing entire towns and villages out to sea. And just the scope of dealing with not only the physical destruction but also the mental health of all these people, many of them whose communities were lost, loved ones lost. You have 1,500 children that lost at least one of their parents. And then, of course, you have to think about the grieving parents, some of whom never recovered the bodies of their children. So it's just a heart-rending human tragedy, and the pain is really still quite fresh 5 years later.
VOA correspondent Steve Herman. Meanwhile, a Japanese court has ordered two restarted nuclear reactors operated by Kansai Electric Power at its Takahama plant west of Tokyo shut down. The action, brought by local residents who feared the risk it poses to local water supplies, is viewed as a temporary setback to efforts by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government to bring dozens of idle plants back online. Jeff Kingston, Asian Studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty in a Skype interview the judge's injunction was a surprise and based on a lack of sufficient evacuation safety drills. And now for a look at what's trending on social media, I'm joined by Andrew Palshevsky. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, good to be with you. So two big stories for Facebook on ways that they're expanding their multi-billion dollar social media empire. The first was a purchase of an app called Masquerade. Now, this allows people to put filters on their photos and make kind of funny faces with their photos, swap faces with other people. And it seems to be, some people are saying, a response to the fact that Facebook tried to buy Snapchat and was unable to, so they're buying this Masquerade app instead. And people are speculating that this is going to be part of the expansion of Facebook into maybe different apps. They've previously purchased Instagram, and so now Instagram is integrated with Facebook. So when you post things to Instagram, you can link it to your Facebook account. So this may be another way to do that with something that's a little lighter, maybe a little silly, but something you might see showing up in your Facebook feed, people swapping faces, or a button next to the like button to swap faces on videos, things like that. We'll see. And the other big move they've made recently is virtual reality, specifically with a product called the Samsung Gear virtual reality headset that you can now like and watch virtual reality 360-degree videos using this headset from Facebook. So they're integrating virtual reality into Facebook. They previously purchased a company called Oculus, which is one of the leaders in virtual reality. And so, again, people are speculating that this is another move that they're trying to make into this new realm. Already, if you go to Facebook and post videos, there's an option that says, is this a 360-degree video? So already, if you do post a 360-degree video, they do give you that option, and I guess trying to integrate it into the virtual reality headsets and the virtual reality products that we're seeing. But big moves for Facebook, big expansions into some new technologies.
Sounds like a whole new reality here.
It absolutely is, and one that I'm sure they're hoping is going to make them a lot more money.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. That's Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA. Well, that was our social media segment with Andrew Palshevsky. Now we go to the interview with VOA's Victor Beatty, who spoke to Jeff Kingston. He's Asian Studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo, about Japan's continuing nuclear difficulties.
So essentially he's saying, we're not satisfied that the reactors are safe, even if they do meet the new safety criteria. And we don't think that the power companies have learned the lessons of Fukushima, because they still are not practicing evacuations. And one of the lessons of Fukushima is you don't want to improvise an evacuation when the reactors are in meltdown and you see plumes of radiation shooting into the atmosphere. So I think that the judge's ruling is widely supported by Japanese people who have deep anxieties about the Abe government's agenda of quickly restarting as many reactors as possible and boosting nuclear energy to about 20-22% of the national energy mix.
So what happens to the nuclear power industry in Japan now?
Well, they have well-paid lawyers whose job is to try to undo that damage. They will file an appeal. The two reactors in question, one of them is already idled because of what they call a glitch. So one of these reactors that was stamped as safe to operate actually already had a problem. So that was shut down. And the other one will be shut down by 8 p.m. today. The thing is that this may have broader implications because around the country, there are similar lawsuits by citizens trying to stop the restart of reactors. And so this ruling, I think, may have stark implications for the nuclear village, which is what people in Japan call the various advocates of nuclear energy in the utilities and the government and politics and academics and the business community.
Well, Jeff, I imagine this is being welcomed by the anti-nuclear movement in Japan.
Yes, but it is an injunction and it was issued at the district court. Last year, we had a similar situation, and the court overturned that injunction.
5 years on, nearly 100,000 people still have been unable to return to the Fukushima area, still more than half of who were forced to flee. But what's the situation here?
What once were vibrant communities have now become ghost towns. And the no-go zone, the evacuation zone, you know, basically these are abandoned towns left as they were and people skedaddled. And many of them are living in temporary housing. And the interesting thing is the secondary deaths, that people were not killed directly by the meltdowns and the release of radiation, but more than 2,000 people have died as refugees.
That's Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute. The launch of NASA's InSight, or Interior Exploration, using seismic investigations, geodesy, and heat transport, has been rescheduled for May 2018, with a Mars touchdown to take place the following November. Its launch had been scheduled for this month, but had to be scrubbed after it was determined that a leak in the prime instrument of the spacecraft science payload could not be repaired on time. Specific planetary alignments that are needed for a launch to Mars occur every 26 months and last for only a couple of weeks. So, since the InSight was unable to make its March 2015 window, the next chance for launch wasn't until May 2018. Scientists hope InSight will provide some evidence about the formation and evolution of all rocky planets, including our own. Unlike Curiosity and other Mars rovers such as Spirit and Opportunity, the InSight lander will remain in a fixed position throughout its mission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music star Chris Stapleton joins the effort to increase awareness of mental health. Myanmar's lower house of parliament Friday, Jin Taw, an unelected retired bureaucrat from the National League for Democracy, trounced the country's incumbent vice president in first-round balloting to move a step closer to the presidency. I spoke with VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who is in Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw.
Well, Sarah, it is unfolding step by step. Somewhat of a convoluted process that's been underway this week and will continue next week, and will finally end at March 30th with a change of with a transition of power ceremony. But what appears inevitable at this point is that sometime next week, the parliament will select the country's next president, and it is not going to be Aung San Suu Kyi, who would be the favorite if there was a public vote on this. She'd win a landslide, but as you may know, she's constitutionally prohibited from taking the presidency because her sons are citizens of a foreign country, namely Britain. So she's had to put a proxy into the contest here in the parliament, which will select the president. And he is going to be a loyalist, someone she's known very well for many years, but that most people in the country have not heard of.
Yes, and I believe he is Tin Jaw.
Yes, Tin Jaw seems to be fairly well qualified, and that's the consensus of even some of the opposition politicians we spoke with today. He spent some years in the bureaucracy, had been a university teacher, studied computer science overseas. He's in the inner circle of the NLD, the National League for Democracy. He's on the executive council, and he's married to a woman who is not only the daughter of one of the founders of the NLD, but she's a member of parliament in her own right.
What about the military? Have they put up a candidate?
Yes, they have. He is quite well known. General Min Swe is the chief minister for the Yangon region, quite a hardliner. And while he is certain to lose the parliamentary vote for president, he is guaranteed at least to be the second vice president. So Aung San Suu Kyi is not going to be able to have everything her way because she will have a second VP, a hardliner general. And the military, of course, has one-fourth of the seats in the parliament reserved for those in uniform. So it's not going to be total easy sailing for Aung San Suu Kyi, despite the landslide victory her party won last November.
That's VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman. Well, in China, the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference are underway. And I'm talking now to VOA's Beijing correspondent, Bill Ide. Bill, at the moment, what is known about the proceedings that are underway?
Well, these are pretty standard proceedings that happen every year. It's a key political meeting. And it's a time and opportunity for a lot of officials to meet with the press. There's a steady stream of press conferences every day, kind of, you know, this contact that we don't really get that regularly here with top-ranking officials. So we do get a lot of messaging, and that's a kind of a key thing that what this is all about. It's an opportunity for the government to kind of take stock on the previous year and how the economic performance was, and discuss a wide range of other problems as well, but also then to get messaging out about the year ahead, what their outlook is for the economy, what kind of key issues the National People's Congress will be looking at, what laws and new regulations that they might be considering that would help address a wide range of social problems that are very persistent and very prominent in the lives of people here in China.
Have there been any concrete announcements yet, or are the discussions still ongoing?
The discussions are still ongoing. There are a few key laws that may be passed during this session. One is a charity law that looks to kind of, for the first time, set up some regulations for charity donations in China. It's something that is needed because it doesn't exist, and there is a huge amount of wealth here, and there are a lot of people that want to, you know, share their wealth and help out with different causes. But it also has some clauses in it that are raising some eyebrows. One in particular referring to national security concerns that appear to give the government a kind of a way to basically clamp down and shut down any kind of charitable organization or donations that they feel are contrary to their ideological desires.
That is Bill Ide in Beijing. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Well, on the heels of his two-time Grammy win and huge surge in popularity, country artist Chris Stapleton tackles mental health awareness in his brand new video for his song Fire Away, and it's created quite a buzz on social media. Nikki Strong of VOA Music fills us in. Nikki, what made Stapleton choose to take on mental health?
Well, the actor in the video, Ben Foster, reportedly introduced Stapleton to ChangeDirection.org, an organization which aims to create a culture in which mental health optimization is valued and achievable. So he was down for the cause, so to speak, and he became a part of the organization's recent campaign to increase mental health awareness by enabling people to identify the five key signs of emotional suffering, which include change in personality, agitation, withdrawal, decline in personal care, and hopelessness.
How does the video go about addressing the issue?
Well, the video is shot like a short film. Chris plays a bartender, and then the actor Ben Foster, who plays a cop, comes to the bar and starts to drink. And then the film goes into a flashback as if we're entering his mind and seeing everything he's thinking. And in his flashback, you see the story of a young married couple, he and his wife. They look like they're living the perfect life. They just move into a new home, they start to fix it up, and then something starts to change in his wife's character. We start to see how those five keys start to manifest and how the husband who loves her dearly is dealing with it. So it's very touching, it's riveting, it's moving. If you've ever had a loved one struggle with depression, or if you've ever dealt with depression yourself, you can really relate to this video. And because it is told through his eyes, you even get a glimpse of how her mental health impacts his. You feel the pain he feels as he endeavors to help the wife he loves, and you feel his determination to love her through thick and thin. And the actors Ben Foster and Margarita Levieva do a great job. So the video is well done. And at the end of it, the website changedirection.org flashes on the screen.
Well, mental health concerns are more common than we know.
Yeah, Change Direction's website says mental health concerns affect 1 in 5 Americans, like depression, anxiety, trauma, and that more people will die from suicide in 2016 than in auto accidents. And I think with this video, Chris Stapleton and changedirection.org is making the mental health awareness less taboo subject and less misunderstood. And ultimately, I think together they're trying to change how our culture overall deals with it. And the Fire Away video has been shared all over social media, so the word is getting out. Hopefully the change will go along with it.
You can see Chris Stapleton's video for Fire Away on his social media by going to facebook.com and looking up VOA Music, or on Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also hear more of Chris Stapleton's music on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. Thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Unload up your questions and pick up your sticks and your stones. And pretend I'm a shelter for heartaches that don't have a home. Choose the words that cut life.
That is the music of Chris Stapleton. And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Pakistan continue to share a fundamental desire for stability, peace, and regional and global economic development. The U.S.-Pakistan Strategic Dialogue provides an opportunity for both countries to find common ground on these issues in spite of past differences. In welcoming remarks, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reaffirmed the United States and Pakistan's commitment to combating terrorism and protecting the people of both countries. The U.S. supports Pakistan's whole-of-government approach to eliminate the ability of militant groups to recruit, finance, and to incite violence. On regional security, both countries will continue efforts to promote stability and defeat those who foment extremism and violence. Cooperation along Pakistan's border remains critical, said Secretary Kerry. Pakistan's military is engaged in ongoing missions in North Waziristan to clear out extremists, and the U.S. has pledged $250 million to help rebuild the communities of persons who have been displaced by the fighting in these operations. With regard to nonproliferation, the U.S. encourages Pakistan to follow the U.S.-Russia example of seeking to reduce its number of nuclear warheads. Economic and development issues were also discussed at the U.S.-Pakistan dialogue. The two countries have a joint plan to expand trade over 5 years in a way that will help make Pakistan's markets more attractive to foreign investors. As part of this, the U.S. is going to partner with Pakistan to expand women's participation in the workplace. A reliable power grid is critical to Pakistan's economic development. That's why the U.S. is helping Pakistan develop a more stable, sustainable, and market-based energy sector. Today, the U.S. has added 1,750 megawatts to the country's electric grid, benefiting nearly 26 million Pakistanis. And through the new U.S.-Pakistan Clean Energy Partnership, it may be possible to add another 3,000 megawatts from clean energy sources. Finally, critical to Pakistan's long-term success is cooperation with the U.S. in education, science, and technology. As Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif stated during his visit here last October, a close and enduring partnership between Pakistan and the U.S. is a strategic imperative for achieving lasting peace and stability in our region and beyond.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorial's internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.